There are copies of that work available, and what I tell people is it makes good kindling if you would need it. If you are looking for a Christmas present for somebody you don't like, that would be appropriate. If you can't sleep at night, 2 pages, and call me in the morning, and you'll be just fine. But I really do have copies, gifts, for anyone who would like to have one. I'd be happy to sign it at some point if you would find that at all of interest to you. Before I jump in, I want to bring greetings from two former pastors. One is Carl Wolf, who writes this on October 8th. Dear friends, your celebration calls for congratulations. The passing of many years suggests that only a few of the older members of the congregation will remember me. My mind holds a huge bag full of memories about events, large and small, which are crowding to get out. For example, the news of Pearl Harbor came over the radio on a Sunday when I happened to be in Cranberry. I presided over the Cranberry Community Memorial Service when John F. Kennedy was assassinated. Many baptisms and weddings and funerals ministered to me, even as I ministered to them. Clarissa and I, C-L-A-R-A-L-I-C-E, Claralis. Thank you very much. And I were there with you for the 250th anniversary celebration. Now the diminishments of old age prevent us from making the trip. We both remember Cranberry Church with deep affection and call God's blessing upon you all and pray for your continuing ministry in the name of Christ. That's from Carl Wolf, who was at the 250th. And then we have greetings from Roger Quam, who was here during the 275th anniversary. So I think... No, I'm sorry, 225th. We're the 275th, aren't we? Okay. And you're trusting me for history. It's really something. He says this. It's more a letter to me, but I'll please share with the 275th anniversary committee my thanks for their letter of October 2nd with gratitude for my ministry in Cranberry 50 years ago. My years there actually span 1957 to 1961, so you can see that I was there to celebrate the 225th anniversary. We had some very talented theatrical people putting on a smashing show in which I participated as a preacher in rather unlike my own conversational style. It was, in their vision, more dramatic to have a fiery Jonathan Edwards. So I was appropriately dressed with wig, cape, and preaching bands. I can so see Roger dressed that way. Great fun, and a handsome brochure was produced. And the rest of the letter is really about me. Now, I don't know if you realize that in these former pastors, you can see them all in the library. And you might know that along that one wall, we've run out of room. And so what I've been told is that when the time finally comes for my portrait to be up there, no, they wanted to keep Lou in a loo, so they've offered me either this restroom or the one in the back of the narthex. Can you hear me okay? As I'm moving, can you hear me back down there? Okay. Am I too loud? Okay. Want to jump in with David Brainerd. Joanne alluded to the fact that David Brainerd's name is seen all over town. The lake, the cemetery, signs at either end of Main Street, the throw that was sold a while ago. I think I've seen one hanging in the Cranberry Inn. The old tap room of the Cranberry Inn itself has one of the murals on the wall that you see David Brainerd. What else is there? I even have a Lions pin, Cranberry Lions, that has David Brainerd preaching, labored among the Indians on it. And there you go. I won't pass it around, but there it is. Okay, why? Why is this guy so special to warrant any of that? And why is he so special here? Because really, he didn't live very long. He only lived about 30 years. He wasn't born here. He didn't die here. He's not even buried in the cemetery that bears his name. And he really, we're going to see, was not even in Cranberry all that long. Less than a year. Well, why? Why is he so important? Well, we first read about his connection with Cranberry from his journal, which is dated June 18th, 1745, and these are his words. This is what he says. Set out from New Brunswick with a design to visit some Indians at a place called Crosswicksung, which is Crosswicks, in New Jersey towards the sea. In the afternoon, came to a place called Cranberry, B-E-R-R-Y. And meeting with a serious minister, Mr. McKnight, I lodged there with him, had some enlargement and freedom in prayer with a number of people. So really, the first connection with Brainerd and Cranberry is that he would stay with McKnight in the Old Manse as he passed through on his way to ministry in Crosswicks. And that was really considered one of the most significant parts of his ministry. The next time we hear about Brainerd, and now pay attention to these dates in particular, is that we see him visiting the Indians who are settled here in Cranberry. They were moved from Crosswicks. I won't go into all the details, but it was very common reasons that Native American Indians were moved from one place to another, and the same thing happened here in 1755, but they were moved from where they were to this general area, Monroe, and Brainerd talks about them going out and clearing the land, but on May 3rd, 1746, he comes down to visit the Indians, I'll just use that phrase because he uses it over and over again, that name, who were settled at Cranberry. And he describes preaching to them out in the wilderness because they didn't have anything built yet. And so that's the image we see of him in a lot of those pictures, is David Brainerd preaching to the Indians underneath a tree in the wilderness. Well, that really happened. The ministry starts with them when they really have no place built yet to live. It takes time for them to develop that. Well, all during this time, David Brainerd is ill. He had tuberculosis. And the signs of that started a number of years earlier when he was 21 years old. We'll go back to a little bit of that. So while he was here, he was also traveling to other places and coming back here and then traveling some more and coming back here. He was constantly on the move. And finally, he was getting so ill that he decides on November 5th, 1746. So he arrived here May 3rd, 1746. He decides to leave November 5th, 1746. It's about 7 months. 7 months is all David Brainerd resided in Cranberry, apart from his passing through on the way to go to Crosswicks. And even during those 7 months, he was not always here. In fact, some accounts that we read in scholarly journals, I read them, in books, don't even mention Cranberry. But they really emphasize Brainerd's ministry in Crosswicks, where he met with a lot of success. And then before that, the Forks of the Delaware, his going to the Susquehanna, and even before that, he got his missionary training in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. So if historians sometimes even overlook that he resided in Cranberry and was part of the Indian town Bethel, part of the establishment with it, why would we view him as so important? Why do we even know the name David Brainerd at all? Well, it may seem like an odd place to start, but let me start here anyway. Well, one reason is because in 1742, David Brainerd was expelled from Yale, which is a very significant event. The reason he was expelled, and boy, I would love, you know, I could do this for hours, but I know we don't have hours. I'm really going to pay attention to time, and my wife tells me not to talk too fast when I'm trying to get in a lot of content. So let me slow down, but still try to give you an overview. The reason he ends up becoming expelled is related to these revivals that Joanne mentioned. By the way, the year 1734, Jonathan Edwards published Divine and Supernatural Light, which was a wonderful sermon that helped propagate that David Brainerd probably read. Okay, the Great Awakening. The awakenings began. And by awakening, remember, this is a Calvinist revival, if you can put those two words together. That is, what was being preached was, don't convert, like not Billy Graham, don't come forward and the buses will wait. But what you need to be aware of, what you need to do is to be awakened to your condition before God as a sinner. And that if that condition doesn't change, if God doesn't change that condition, you are going to go to hell. And so one of the most infamous sermons preached during this is preached in 1741. By Jonathan Edwards, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. Interestingly enough, when he preached at his own congregation, there was no effect. But when he preached it in Enfield, Connecticut, it was enormous effect. Is this air going to around too much? Okay. Well, they actually started in little revivals in different areas around us, though. They actually started in the 1720s around us. In New Brunswick and in the New Brunswick area, and out in Neshaminy, where a log college was founded, where ministers were trained, including Gilbert Tennant and his brother William Tennant, started by their father, the senior William Tennant, and Samuel Blair, the first minister we called here, who, by the way, didn't accept, and Charles McKnight, who later did accept, were educated at that log college. But in the 1720s, these revivals start largely through a Dutch pastor, but who comes in contact with Gilbert Tennant. This person, who is our first supply preacher, named, if you read our historical brochures, 1738. He's the first one who kind of preaches here on a regular basis. And he is one of the key figures of what would later become the Great Awakening. That's the 1720s. In the 1730s, through the ministry of Jonathan Edwards in New England and the Connecticut River Valley, awakenings start to break out up there. And David Brainerd would have read all about those, because one of the key things about Jonathan Edwards is he's the one who writes the history, the chronicle, in a work called A Faithful Narrative in 1737. He writes this, and the news of this starts to spread. It starts to spread throughout the colonies. It goes over to England. John Wesley is interested in this. Isaac Watts is interested in what's going on here. And so this news, this revival stuff, John Wesley is having some revival going on over in England. There's all this stuff going on, and it reaches kind of the beginning of the climax of it in 1740, actually late 1739. When a man named George Whitfield arrives in the States, he was an associate of John Wesley, preaching to numbers of people. Whitfield lands in the colonies and he itinerates all through the colonies. All through the colonies. In fact, this is the first intercolonial event before the American Revolution. It's a significant event. It's significant in terms of communication, because there's correspondence as people start writing about everybody being awakened. And a journal is started, the first journal in the New World called The Christian History is started to chronicle all of these revivals, because it starts to really break out. He preaches to thousands in Philadelphia. He preaches to thousands in Boston Common. I've even had record, I don't know if he actually preached here, but I can't find that yet, but it wouldn't surprise me if he actually preached here, because I know he preached nearby here to at least a crowd of 1,000 or 1,500 people. And because of the association with Gilbert Tennant, he may very well, and I don't know this for sure, but I would not be surprised if he preached here. Well, okay, I could tell you much, much more about that, about what's going on, but I won't. But how it affects Brainerd? Well, Whitfield went to Yale. He preached at Harvard and went to Yale. The first time around, they kind of accepted him, but then things started to get a little iffy. Because after Whitfield passed through Yale, guess who was next? Gilbert Tennant came through. Because Whitfield encouraged Tennant to do a little bit of the kind of tour that he did. Tennant goes through New England and preaches this revivalism stuff, and people are responding. Then after Tennant, somebody else comes through Yale, stirs everybody up. And then finally, this guy named James Davenport, who probably really was non compos mentis, who was a pastor on Long Island, I say no more, goes over and he starts really stirring people up. It would be something like this. This is the kind of stuff people were hearing. It would be like if somebody who wasn't from Cranberry went and set up at the gazebo by the lake and was drawing people from Cranberry, from the three churches of Cranberry, and then was starting to tell them, look, we really doubt if your pastor, if that Lou Mitchell, is really converted and a Christian. We're not so sure. We're not so sure about the Methodist guy or the Episcopal woman. They may not be Christians. In fact, it's Gilbert Tennant who, a little bit later, not during this tour, but preaches one of the most infamous sermons of the Great Awakening entitled The Dangers of an Unconverted Ministry. When they started calling out ministers as not being converted. The first time through, ministers opened their pulpits to these people. Well, guess what? They didn't open them anymore. So they're preaching out. They're preaching out. And they're preaching against. Well, that was what was happening at Yale. These guys are getting so stirred up. It wasn't necessarily Whitfield, but by the time Davenport gets there, they're so whipped up that the students are starting to question, well, maybe the president, Clapp isn't converted. Maybe the tutors we have, the teachers aren't, maybe the trustees aren't converted. Well, Yale didn't like hearing that. In fact, they passed at commencement time in 1741, they passed a law within the university that said if any student is heard calling a member of the Yale community, officials or whatever, as unconverted, or what they would say a hypocrite, one who looked like a Christian but really wasn't, that they were in danger of expulsion. And they were hoping that the, I want to say confirmation, commencement speaker that year would kind of calm things down. Because the commencement speaker was one who was himself a Yalie, and who at one time earlier saved Yale by becoming one of the head teachers at Yale, and that was Jonathan Edwards, comes and he doesn't do what they want him to do. The Yale administration wants Edwards to just draw down anathema on all of this stuff that's going on, and a lot of it had to do with emotionalism. They called it enthusiasm. See, a lot of people thought that the proper religion is the religion of the head, and you learn the right doctrine, and that's how you do it. And then there are people doing all kinds of crazy things emotionally and ranting and raving against those who aren't with them. Well, Edwards does this. He says, even though he acknowledges freely that all this stuff is going on, he says, even though all this stuff is going on, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's not a genuine work of God's Spirit. That sermon would later be published as distinguishing marks of a work of the Spirit of God. Well, Brainerd heard that. Brainerd was there through a lot of this. He was actually an old student. He was 21 when he entered, and usually students were about 17. So that next year, he and a couple of other people who were very serious, and I haven't said a lot about the characteristic of David Brainerd, but by this time, he was showing signs of the tuberculosis that would kill him, and he had a very melancholy kind of disposition. Extremely serious. And he and some other of the students were going around, much like Wesley did at Oxford over in England, and his brother, and talking with the other students, having a ministry there. And sometime during that year, it was hearsay, But Brainerd was overheard making the comment that one of the teachers at Yale had no more grace than a chair. Which means you can just fill in what he's really saying. He was overheard saying that. And although the process he went through really wasn't the process that was announced, it really wasn't fair because it didn't meet all the criteria of what the rule was. And it was in a way kind of shameful because it was just about before his own graduation and he would have graduated top of the class. He's expelled. He's kicked out. So he has to find an alternate route to finish his credentials, which he does really through a Scottish organization, aligned then with Presbyterians. And he has to find a kind of an alternate route to ministry so he becomes a missionary. So that's part of the effect of him being expelled, but one of the biggest effects has to do with some of the ministers who were around here. People like Gilbert Tennant, who was connected with this church. People like Samuel Blair, who was the first one called here in 1738 but didn't accept, but who went to Pennsylvania and started kind of his own academy of training ministers and later trained one of the people who would be the fourth president of Yale, Samuel Davies. Aaron Burr, the father of the infamous Aaron Burr, vice president of the United States. His father married a daughter of Jonathan Edwards. You can see how all these things are kind of connected. And Burr had a significant pastorate in Newark and the most significant Presbyterian of them all in this area, a man by the name of Jonathan Dickinson, who pastored in Elizabethtown. Well, these people had already begun to see that there was a need for another institution to train ministers. Out of the Presbyterian tradition, the log college that was in the Chemeny had produced a good number, but that was no longer doing the job and that was no longer being recognized in the way it used to be. They needed something more established. And some of these people, like Dickinson and Burr, who were Yale graduates themselves, were so, what's the word we can say? Disappointed in the direction Yale had taken and how they treated David Brainerd. That these are the people who are the first two presidents and the trustees of the College of New Jersey, which becomes Princeton University. So you can honestly say that David Brainerd's expulsion from Yale is it's a cause de celeb for the founding of what becomes Princeton University. But not only that. When Brainerd left Bethel and Cranberry because he was getting so ill, he wanted to make his way to New England. But he couldn't make it all the way because he was so ill. So he ends up in Elizabethtown, New Jersey, where Jonathan Dickinson lived. Just shortly after the charter in 1746 for the College of New Jersey arrives and Dickinson is declared the first president of the College of New Jersey, which becomes Princeton. Brainerd ends up living with Dickinson something like 6 months or so, a number of months. And he's there right after the charter and right before the time when the first formal classes are started, and they're started in Dickinson's home. And when Dickinson dies, they would start in Aaron Burr's home, and it was Burr who would move the college down to Princeton, and Nassau Hall would be built, and that yellow house next to Nassau Hall would be built. That's under Aaron Burr's presidency. So according to custom, because Brainerd is in the home of the one who is the president of the new college, and because that person is a mentor of his, he is officially the first enrolled student of Princeton University. He is significantly important for the conditions under which Princeton was founded, but that's not why we know him. Can you keep going with me for a little bit? Anybody need a bathroom break? Go to the one that my picture's going to be in. The reason we know David Brainerd is because after he left Jonathan Dickinson's home, after he came back one more time to visit the Indians in Cranberry, he actually married Jonathan Dickinson while he was there. Not that the two of them married, but he performed the ceremony for Dickinson while Dickinson was married. Is because Brainerd goes to New England and ends up in the home of, guess who? Jonathan Edwards, who actually becomes the third president of Princeton. We won't go into that now. And he is taken care of by Edwards' daughter, Jerusha. And there's, if I had more time, I'd tell you about, there's the debate, were they romantically involved or you know, were they or weren't they kind of thing. But for 19 weeks, Jerusha tends for Brainerd, even accompanying him to Boston, which was not at all inappropriate at the time, and coming back, and Brainerd dies in Edwards' home. Just so you know, Jerusha died not too long afterwards of tuberculosis, which he contracted from Brainerd, and in the Northampton Cemetery, they are buried side by side. You make of that what you will. But because he dies, and he's with Jonathan Edwards during his last months, he entrusts his journal to Jonathan Edwards. This is actually, interestingly enough, the Yale edition of the works of Jonathan Edwards that publishes the diary of David Brainerd. I should also tell you that David Brainerd was awarded his degree posthumously when Bart Giamatti, who used to be the commissioner of baseball, was president of Yale. Probably for fundraising purposes, but never mind. Edwards has this diary. And that's why we know David Brainerd. Because Edwards edits the diary, takes out some of the melancholy episodes that are so often in Brainerd, and he publishes it to the world. Now what you have to know is this. Brainerd very much tried to live his life according to the model that Edwards laid out in his writings. And in the journal, Edwards presents Brainerd as the one who most significantly lived his life according to the standards of what Edwards considered a true Christian should be. This is the end of an appendix that Edwards wrote at the end of Brainerd's journal. He says this, "The Lord grant that also that the foregoing account of Mr. Brainerd's life and death may be for the great spiritual benefit of all that shall read it and prove a happy means of promoting the revival of true religion in these parts of the world." So Edwards presents Brainerd as the model of what a true Christian should look like, about what all of these people, Gilbert Tennant and Edwards and Whitfield and Blair and McKnight and everybody who's been preaching about what a Christian should look like. If you want to see what a Christian looks like, look at David Brainerd. Read his diary. That's one of the reasons why we know of David Brainerd, but that's not all. There's two more quick ones I'm going to tell you. John Wesley was also taken by David Brainerd and the diary. In fact, he had the diary published in England. And he, an abridged version of it, which actually went through several publications. And for Wesley, the second category is that Brainerd was not only the ideal Christian, he was the ideal pastor. So Wesley writes this, "Find preachers of David Brainerd's spirit, and nothing can stand before them. Let every preacher read carefully over the life of David Brainerd. Let us be followers of him as he was of Christ, in absolute self-devotion, in total deadness to the world, and in fervent love to God and man." And in fact, in the manual of Methodist ministry, Wesley calls attention to the diary of David Brainerd. So Brainerd becomes not only the model for what a true Christian should look like, not only the model for what a true pastor should look like, but that's not why we really know him. Because through the journal of David Brainerd, published by Jonathan Edwards, John Wesley, and others, and the greatest area of impact that David Brainerd makes is in the area of missions. Not just missions in America, but foreign missions as well. The whole mission enterprise of the 19th century. Joanne reminded me that there were groups of women who would gather and read the journal of David Brainerd, and they would be promoting missions. There are all kinds of those kinds of groups going on. The noted historian of missions, Andrew Wall, says this: by the early 19th century, Brainerd became the Protestant icon of the missionary, its ideal type, because of his journal. William Carey, who is known as the father of modern missions, who was a missionary to India, says this, that the life of Brainerd was, quote, almost a second Bible, end quote. Carey's assistant, Henry Martin, was so very much captivated by Brainerd that he said, I long to be like him. David Livingston, the well-known missionary to Africa, was inspired by David Brainerd's journal. And even closer to our time, in 1956, a man by the name of Jim Elliott, a missionary to Ecuador, to a South American tribe, shortly before he is killed and martyred by that tribe, shortly after they land, writes this: Confession of pride suggested by David Brainerd's diary yesterday, he was reading, must become an hourly thing with me. He had just written that. And then his life was taken. Interestingly enough, his wife, Elizabeth Elliott, went back to those very people who killed her husband. And she became a missionary to them and lived among them. And you can read about this in a book called Shadow of the Almighty, The Life and Testament of Jim Elliott, which was published in 1958. Okay, so we come to our conclusion. Why was David Brainerd important? Why is it fitting that the lake here in Cranberry be called Brainerd Lake? Why is it fitting that we see all depictions of him preaching to the Indians? Well, we've already established some things, haven't we? Because he brought the Indians here from Crosswicks and established Bethel, which after he left was the leadership of which was taken over by Brainerd's brother John Brainerd, who stayed until 1755 when the Indians were forced to leave, in a not very good way for looking upon our history as white people. But he also was very much involved in the founding of Princeton University. And how much has that affected this area in which we live? He was the model of the Great Awakening. He was involved in the Great Awakening. He was involved in the network of people. It's just amazing, the network of people that are tied into one another with these revivals, and Brainerd was very much tied into that. He was presented as the ideal Christian. He was presented as the ideal pastor. And he was presented as the ideal missionary. Eugene Stock himself, an historian of missions, writes in 1899, Brainerd did less in his lifetime than his biography by Jonathan Edwards did after he was gone. Do you hear that? He did less in his lifetime than what his journal did after he was gone. In its pages is presented the picture of a man of God such as is rarely seen. No book has directly or indirectly borne richer fruit. And that is why we know David Brainerd. Thank you.